Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, October 2nd, day two of the federal government shutdown. We hear more from our Hawaii congressional delegation, and we also check in with the Pacific Historic Parks on delays in staffing. The USS Arizona Memorial is the most popular visitor site in the state. We learn about the return of the Maui County Fair after 6 years. The festivities kick off today. And we catch a wave with an up-and-coming surfer from the North Shore. She recently took fifth in a worldwide contest. And giving a voice to trash, we hear from a musician slash artist with a new spin on Kani Kapila. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The standoff continues in our nation's capital as the government shutdown has sent federal offices scrambling to figure out what it has to close and what it can keep open. Here with the latest is HBR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I know, you know, we had a Representative Ed Case on yesterday. You've been in contact with other members of our delegation. So what's the latest?
Right. And so, yeah, I spoke with Ed Case as well yesterday and Congresswoman Jill Tokuda. You know, Hawaii has about 24,000 civilian federal employees and about 47,000 active duty military service members being impacted by the government shutdown. You know, although they'll receive back pay once the shutdown ends, federal workers will really be feeling the most immediate impacts. Although, you know, essential employees like air traffic controllers, TSA agents, and mail carriers will still work, you know, many people may not be available to help navigate services. And then, you know, with less people administering the services, it's going to become increasingly difficult to get that out to people, even if it's supposed to be delivered. So to expect some disruptions that may get worse the longer the shutdown lasts.
Yeah, I happened to be at the VA yesterday, and it was fascinating because things were changing almost minute by minute. Folks weren't sure if they were going to be open today, if they're going to be open Friday. They said they might have visits or appointments by Zoom. And then I overheard a conversation saying, oh, you know, two nurses were told they were furloughed and they left. And so, yeah, very uncertain with you know, so many people affected.
Yeah, you know, like departments like U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency have way over more than half of their staff has been furloughed. You know, Hawaii Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says if the shutdown continues for an extended amount of time, more services will be impacted.
When you look at things like food benefits, EBT, SNAP, WIC, those will continue to be paid out, but they're using contingency funds. So if this draws out for an extensive period of time, there is going to be concern about whether or not we can still continue to pay those benefits.
I just heard back from the State Department of Human Services that says that SNAP benefits are currently funded through the end of October 2025, so there shouldn't be disruption to benefits for households during that period, and that during the last government shutdown, which was in 2018 and lasted 35 days, the U.S. Department of Agriculture actually made arrangements to issue a second month of benefits in advance to households, but it's not clear yet if that allowance is going to be made with the current shutdown if it continues for longer than 30 days, but that they're monitoring the situation closely, and they'll be continuing to coordinate with the governor's office and other state agencies if the situation lasts longer. Representative Ed Case said, you know, the shutdown could be over in a matter of days if Democrats and Republicans can compromise and come to some bipartisan agreement. But really, the center of the shutdown is a disagreement between Democrats and Republicans over Medicaid cuts in H.R. 1, the big mega bill, and the extending tax credits in the Affordable Care Act, which will end this year. You know, without the enhanced tax credits, people who use plans through the Affordable Care Act could see their insurance premiums more than double. Here's Senator Brian Schatz speaking on the floor of the Senate yesterday.
People are going to lose their health care. This is not a joke. This is not a political talking point. This is what's going to happen across the country. The idea that this is some Democratic priority or independent priority or Republican priority is nonsense. Tens of millions of people are specifically going to see a 114% increase, and everybody else is in the same risk pool. And so all we're saying is, look, this is a very damaging issue for Republicans. And if we were terribly cynical, we would just let them stew in it. But we want to solve it because we care in our bones about the people we represent. And so there is still an opportunity to do something about this.
Representative DeCuda says that if Congress does not extend the Affordable Care Act enhanced subsidies, people are going to start getting rate increase notification letters in the coming weeks, and that people who do use Obamacare are mostly farmers and small business owners.
You can imagine when you're hit with that kind of a monthly increase, you're going to have to make the impossible choice. Do I cover myself and my family, my kids, with health care? Or do I put food on the table? Can I continue to pay my rent and my electricity bill? And so what we are pushing for is let's keep government open and let's do the right things by Americans and save healthcare.
You know, there are about 10,000 people in Hawaii that would be impacted by the expiration of those enhanced subsidies through the Affordable Care Act, and that through the Medicaid cuts that are coming, like implementing work requirements and increasing eligibility checks, it could put about 30,000 people in Hawaii at risk of losing their health coverage here.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah. And also compounding this, you know, both Tokuda and Case were very concerned about announcements from the president about permanently reducing the federal workforce during the government shutdown. Case says that the president does not have the power to do that.
These are not people that will remain on the job but furloughed without getting paid. These are people that he says he will outright fire. That's irresponsible. It's intimidation, really. It's in all likelihood illegal. He doesn't have that unilateral authority, at least without going through very specific procedures. I mean, frankly, it's just cruel.
You know, there have been reports that labor unions are considering litigation, House Speaker Mike Johnson has said that because the government is shut down, Congress has tied its hands, and it's really up to the executive branch to make those decisions on personnel. And throughout the shutdown as well, you know, the United States Office of Management and Budget also announced that it will be rescinding about $7.5 billion in energy funding nationwide. And Hawaii was listed as one of the impacted states. Notably, the listed states were all blue states, you know, California, Illinois, Washington, et cetera. And so it's not totally clear yet what projects in Hawaii are being targeted and how much funding is going to be targeted here. But Tokuda says that the loss of funding will be felt here.
These funds were approved by Congress jointly, Democrats and Republicans. And so we'll dig further as to what projects in Hawaii will be impacted by the rescinding of these Department of Energy funds. All I will say is, I'm sure regardless of the project, they were important to our state. They were jobs for our people. You know, it would likely be reducing energy costs in a state that has the highest, you know, energy costs in the country. And so this will be devastating to Hawaii, and we're going to keep fighting to try to get funds like this restored.
And, you know, in the coming days, I think on Friday, the Senate is slated to do another round of votes on this funding bill. And so we'll have to wait and see until then whether or not they can come up with a compromise to end this government shutdown.
Yeah, no, it's very disheartening because there is concern by so many that, you know, that the blue states are going to suffer. You know, we heard that the transportation funds were pulled for California and New York. So that's a little scary. We've got rail opening this month, you know, and you hope that we aren't on the end of that stick.
Yeah, and when you think back to previous government shutdowns, you know, in 2018, it lasted 35 days. And so it's really not clear right now, you know, how long this is going to persist and, you know, what changes are going to happen in the next couple of days that are going to impact, you know, the federal workers, and what services are going to continue to run and be open, and how many people are going to be furloughed or possibly even terminated. I've seen estimates that have come out that the White House has said possibly thousands of people will be terminated from their jobs during this government shutdown. And so we're really just waiting and seeing to see what happens.
Yeah, it's a very scary time, not just for government employees, but the vendors, defense contractors. It's their livelihood, right?
Exactly.
And how they get food on the table.
Right.
But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the government shutdown. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizzou has been talking to members of our congressional delegation. You can follow our coverage on the evolving situation at hawaiipublicradio.org. This morning, tours are back on as scheduled at the USS Arizona Memorial. That was not the case yesterday morning when the government shutdown caused confusion at the national park. Crowds waited outside hoping they would be accommodated. That did happen during the last shutdown because of private donations through the Pacific Historic Parks helped to pay for National Park Service staff to stay on the job. Yesterday, the visitors were encouraged to visit the other sites, the USS Bofin submarine, the Missouri, and the Aviation Museum, which were open since the approvals for Arizona did not come until around 11 o'clock in the morning. We talked to Jim McCoy, Pacific Historic Parks Communications Director, just as he was arriving on scene today. He said a family visiting from Oregon waited for hours yesterday, but were so pleased that they could get out to the memorial.
There was a couple that was one of the came through the gate and they were lining up in there to get the QR code on the Arizona Memorial tickets. And I just said, how are you guys? And they said, oh, we're good. You know, 4 hours. They weren't complaining. They said they were happy to be there because they have a relative who was killed in the Arizona and his name is on the wall and the shrine wall. So they went out and I actually accompanied them on that trip because I was interested in their story. And it's their first time in the memorial. So they were very pleased to be here. And that's hopefully reflective of most visitors because there are statistics that show that a large percentage of people flying into Hawaii visitors want to see the Pearl Harbor National Memorial and the accompanying parks. You know, the last big shutdown was in 2018, I think late December, lasted 35 days. And we opened too. We're open because Pacific Historic Parks led the charge to make sure that we raise the money, the funds through our respective nonprofits and through donors to make sure that the parks stay open. So we did it then. We hope to continue to do it now. And we certainly hope that the shutdown doesn't last 35 days. So that's to be determined.
And this is really all thanks to the donations that have come in to help keep our parks open. You know, I mean, it's terrific mm-hmm. that one family was able to get on because I'm sure that was, you know, really their trip, right? The highlight of their trip.
That meant so much. They're coming back today because they didn't get to see the movie and they're going to do the audio tour with Jamie Lee Curtis's voice talking to them through the museum. They did the virtual reality tour yesterday and they were really excited by that. So they got to see something, but, you know, they did spend a couple hours outside waiting in the line. So they had a limited day, but they're coming back today. So they're probably likely going to go see the Missouri today, too. So they're just an example of the tourists, the visitors that come, and the locals that come, too. You know, we're always encouraging Tom Aina to come because it is history in our own backyard. And I've talked to so many people who say, oh, I came in fourth grade, and they're 40 years old. I go, okay.
Yes.
Come on to history.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact that you have the Battleship Missouri Memorial, the submarine Bofin as well, and the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, I mean, you know, each tells a different story about that point in time.
Yeah, and they're our partner parks, and they're what we did is everybody pitched in equally, you know, so all four. So that was how we're united and we're trying to keep this iconic park open.
Well, you know, the big question is, yes, how long the shutdown will happen. But at least for the foreseeable future, our visitors will be able to come down there and pay their respects.
Yes, they will. And there is, like I said, we've been in the news a lot lately because of the platform project, the construction at the Arizona Memorial. There were some instances in the beginning that the people couldn't go on the memorial, and that was unfortunate. But that's because of safety reasons. And the construction is ongoing. Hopefully it's getting done quickly, but it's got to be done right.
That was Jim McCoy, Director of Communications for the Pacific Historic Parks, who was talking about how the plan to keep the USS Arizona Memorial open during the shutdown, along with the Battleship Missouri Memorial, the Pacific Fleet Submarine Museum, and the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum. It's all thanks to donations from the community. Look for links on our website if you'd like to visit the historic sites.
Join us on Saturday, October 4th at 2 p.m. for an intimate event from HPR's Live from the Atherton and The Moth. Learn more about crafting your story from director and producer of The Moth, Michelle Jalowski. Seating in our Atherton studio is limited. Tickets are available at hprtickets.org.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping, with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Primate researchers and conservationist Goodall passed away this week. She studied the social and family lives of wild chimpanzees for six decades and changed our understanding of the primates by documenting their tool use, diet, and organization. Goodall's research took her to East Africa to a chimpanzee reserve. But for today's quiz, we wanted to test your knowledge about a primate sanctuary closer to home. This primate sanctuary has housed New World monkeys for more than four decades. The facility isn't open to the public and relies on interns and volunteers to care for the monkeys. We reached out to the facility back in 2018, where founder Lucy Wormser told us about the inhabitants. Take a listen.
They're mostly tamarins and marmosets, who are the small arboreal. They live high in the trees, little monkeys from the rainforest. And that's the sounds that you hear. Are those high, wonderful sounds that they communicate with each other and tell each other where they are, what they're eating, if there's a hawk overhead, if it's raining. And some of their sounds are just amazing music.
Now, according to the sanctuary's website, its location in Hawaii was chosen as it is the only place in America where the climate is similar to the monkeys' native jungles in South and Central America. For today's quiz, we want to know, where is this facility located? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is coming to Blaisdell Concert Hall October 9th and 10th. Don't wait, wait. Tickets are on sale now. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org/waitwait. sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners and Hawaii Pacific University.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Need a fair fix? Well, the Valley Isle then may be the place to be as the Maui County Fair returns after a six-year hiatus. Here to talk about that is HPR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I understand this fair kicks off today.
It is. It's a big weekend for Maui and, whoever else wants to hop on over there. As you said, they're returning after 6 years. The fair has been going for 98 years on Maui. And it will feature E.K. Fernandez rides, contests, food booths, music, hula, exhibits, farm animals, even an esports competition for students. It's the only county fair happening in the state this year, the mayor told me that he is aware of. You know, the 50th state fair on Oahu is on pause right now. And so, you know, this is a big deal for the community. In 2019, they had 80,000 people attend the Maui Fair, and they said they're expecting more this year. So it's it's going to be a crowd.
Yeah, and after what Maui's been through, I mean, gosh, we need this fair.
Absolutely. So Mayor Richard Bisson shared with me a little bit about the history of the event, as well as what it means to the community.
The first fair began in 1916 here on Maui. So it's been around for obviously a very long time. Unfortunately, there was a pause taken over the past 6 years for various reasons. And in response, especially to what we've been through over the past 2 years, it was really, really important. I know to myself, and I'm certain the county council and, of course, all the leadership and all the folks in our community to have it resume. The fair is not, it's more than just an event, right? I mean, it cultivates our community, our culture, all the connections that we make. You know, it's going to promote healing. It's going to promote unity. And above all, we celebrate the resiliency of our community that they've demonstrated over the last couple of years. And this just gives everyone an opportunity to reunite, just to be in an environment that is positive, that is designed to bring joy to from the youngest to the oldest that come out there. And people look forward to the food, the music, the free entertainment, the exhibits, the rides, the games. But it really is the connecting with one another.
Yeah, I like that idea. Just bring the joy, right?
Absolutely. Just a chance for everyone to get together and have fun. So the county did appropriate $1.5 million to support the fair this year. You know, as Mayor said, it hasn't been going for the past 6 years. One of those, you know, of course, was COVID, but also some financial challenges. And so with the county support this year, it is able to move forward. You know, back in the day, it used to be held at the old fairgrounds in Kahului next to the National Guard Armory. And now it's at War Memorial Complex in Wailuku. It all starts today and it goes until Sunday. So today there is a parade to kick off the fair starting at 4:30 today. And then the fair is open today from 5 to 11. Tomorrow, it's also open in the evening from 5 p.m. until midnight. Saturday, it's open all day, and Sunday, the same. So a packed weekend for fairgoers. Daryl Fujiwara is the fair coordinator. He's actually from Lahaina. And he is contracted by the county to wrangle it all together, you know, the logistics, the magnitude of the logistics of an event like this is just kind of mind-boggling. He shared some of those logistical challenges behind the event and how it all came together.
It's a very, very arduous and crazy journey, but in partnership with the County of Maui, because they hold the lease and the property for all of this, they've been very, very supportive in making sure we have all of the infrastructure that we needed to get done. There's the permitting from fire, from building permits, health permits, you name it, all the different county departments are jumping in to help bring in barriers to make sure we have enough, you know, lighting. It's been a huge, huge undertaking. As an event coordinator, like when you're doing a dinner or birthday party, you call the balloon guy, you call the clown and all of that. And so as an event coordinator by profession, like we are contracting everyone to come and do their job to the best of their abilities. Of course, the rides were a huge component. And so they were one of the first calls that I made. And here in the islands, everybody knows everybody. And so a lot of my friends had already kind of reached out to Scott Fernandez, who is the current owner and operator of Ike Fernandez. And he's the son of a son of a son who, you know, for many years here in Hawaii brought amusement and fun to the islands. And so, you know, he had a few non-negotiables that needed to happen in order to get the rides over here. But right away, he was a very big yes.
Oh, that's terrific. You know, the rides are such a key component of a fair.
Yeah, absolutely. And Daryl was sharing with me that E.K. Fernandez used to actually charter a barge and go to all the different islands, and the counties would share that cost. But with COVID and the other counties not hosting as many fairs recently, you know, it's kind of a bigger deal for them to load up all of that equipment and come over to Maui. But speaking of the rides, everybody's wondering what kinds of rides there are. So Pharaoh's Fury, which is the one that kind of swings back and forth. There's Wacky Worm, which is like a cakey roller coaster, you know, a small kind roller coaster. Waves Swinger, like the swings swirl around, you know, dizzying speed. Zero Gravity, like the tilting one. They have a whole bunch. And so it's for sure going to be a wild ride. But, you know, over these 98 years that the fair has been on Maui, everyone growing up, you know, on Maui has favorite memories of the event. And even Mayor Bisson and Daryl shared some of theirs. You know, for the mayor, it was back in the 70s. You know, for Daryl, it was more recently that he remembers going to the fair as a kid. But those memories are fun to talk about. And here they share a little bit about their favorite parts of the fair.
You know, they had this live pony rides that were attached to like a merry-go-round, actually. And you could get on the saddles, they put you on, and just they'd be like five or six small horses and ponies going around the track. So, you know, the Portuguese society, they had an old stove that they would cook, you know, bread right there, fresh Portuguese bread, and they'd serve Portuguese bean soup.
People came to the fair to enjoy food that they couldn't get all year round. And yes, now they have prepackaged cotton candy, but back then you had to wait and get it spun, you know, when I was younger. And so that's what I always loved, is like taking home bags of it and hoarding them. So, you know, as long as I could.
yes, the cotton candy.
Oh, yes. And, you know, so many nonprofits, local business people, they have so many vendors coming out this year. And so just for them, you know, it's a big deal to have this boost in their businesses and the support of the community coming together. So the county's also sponsored a shuttle service for Lanai'i residents coming over on Saturday.
Nice.
And yeah, and boat rides for Molokai'i residents to come over on Sunday. Although I hear they were in very high demand and limited supply, and those are all claimed. They were an application process and snapped up quickly from what I understand. But there is parking, shuttle situation, you know, lots of logistics going on. All the details are on the mauifair.com, and it's all there, and it'll be a fun weekend.
All right. Well, glad you're there to enjoy it. But thanks so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel. You can find her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. The World Surf League completed its 2025 Women's Championship Tour last month. and Hawaii's Betty Lou Sakura Johnson took fifth overall. But Sakura Johnson first made a splash in professional surfing back in 2022. That's when the first-year pro beat five-time champion and Olympic gold medalist Carissa Moore to win the Haleiwa Challenger Surfing Contest. Since then, Sakura Johnson has been steadily climbing the ranks. HBR's Russell Subiono brings us the profile of this 20-year-old who grew up on Oahu's North Shore.
When she's in the lineup, Betty Lou Sakura Johnson describes herself as a competitor.
Betty Lou is able to catch up to this wave. It's really moving quickly, but she's matching the speed. Watching a nice arc in the pocket for Betty Lou. She's inspired and firing. Nice little roll in for Betty Lou. Big snap there, teeing off the lip, jams it under the lip on the second one. Nice drive off the lip line. Two massive maneuvers for Betty Lou Sakura Johnson.
Outside the water, she's a humble and unassuming young woman. I got the chance to meet her recently as she was helping arrange tables at a restaurant in Kahuku. That's where her sponsor Ruka was throwing a friends and family dinner to celebrate her top five finish. Quite the accomplishment, considering she grew up focused on other sports.
Growing up, surfing was not my main sport. I was a gymnast and a dirt bike rider before I started really getting into surfing. But every day, mom and dad would just always hang out at the beach, and that kind of just turned out on hopping on a board and getting in pushed into waves since very young.
But those early years of gymnastics and dirt bike riding, they haven't gone to waste. Sakura Johnson says many of the lessons she learned translates during her time on the waves and has helped her succeed beyond expectations.
Well, gymnastics, I feel like that helped a lot with the way I surf nowadays because of just the balance and the technique that you need to have doing gymnastics that kind of just formatted into my surfing. With dirt biking, I feel like you really just have to be super confident on your bike, and I feel like that confidence has helped me, you know, in the water a lot, you know, just trusting my instincts more. And it is a lot different than dirt bike riding. Surfing is very uncontrollable. You're going against the ocean, but it kind of has that very similar things to it.
Competing on the 9-month-long 12-stop WSL Women's Championship Tour has taken the young Sakura Johnson from her tiny hometown of Haleiwa to places like Abu Dhabi, El Salvador, and South Africa, and to legendary breaks like Fiji's Cloudbreak and Te Ahupo'o in Tahiti. To the casual observer, surfing big waves might seem like an insurmountable task. Sakura Johnson says she takes it one wave at a time.
It is definitely a process, you know, to be able to become comfortable in bigger waves, especially more in powerful waves. It's honestly just more time in the ocean and consistently just like trying to show up and learn the wave or learn the ocean more and understand it a bit more. But it is definitely scary. I've been scared a lot this past few years, you know, trying to push my limits and push myself in bigger surf. So it is spooky. But the reward of, you know, making a beautiful ride at Te Ahupo'o is like insane. And it's a feeling that you're going to want to keep chasing forever.
Putting in the work to excel at a professional level doesn't seem typical for young people her age. But then again, Sakura Johnson is anything but typical. She attributes her work ethic and her ability to overcome challenges to her parents. Her mom, Shinobu, is originally from Japan, and her father, Jeremiah, grew up in Minnesota and was later stationed at Schofield Barracks. He's called Oahu home for the last 30 years.
I feel like my work ethic has come from my parents a lot. They're very hardworking parents. They're definitely not the definition of lazy. They're always constantly working and, you know, trying to improve themselves, whatever it is. And I think that also just changed into like the way I love surfing and how that's been able to turn into a career for me at such a young age is a big blessing. And I've been able to keep myself busy with that. I want to, you know, be my best. I want to work hard to be my best. So I think that's where my drive comes from.
That drive and work ethic led her to two first place finishes on the championship tour. Sakura Johnson says her favorite memory is her first contest victory, which came on the Gold Coast of Australia.
As we wait to make it official, Betty Lou goes big and burly. The Hawaiian just dropped a big hammer on the Gold Coast and takes her very first championship tour win.
As her victories increase, so does the spotlight. Fame can often be a challenge for young people to manage, But Sakura Johnson navigates hers with the same grace and maturity that she uses to conquer waves.
I try not to actually think that much of becoming a public figure, but I love that I'm able to inspire younger generations and younger girls. I think that's one of the best things I've been able to do at this young age. And with the platform that I have is, you know, being able to inspire the younger girls to get after it and get out there and, you know, do what you want to do. And I think that's one of the best things I've been able to do.
So what's next for Sakura Johnson? Competing for a spot on the tour next year for sure. She says there's plenty of waves around the world that she dreams about seeing in person and surfing. She mentions a break named Hollow Trees in Indonesia. But can we expect to see her work her way up to the upper echelon of big waves, like Nazaré in Portugal, or Mavericks in Half Moon Bay, California, or Peahi, Jaws, off the coast of Maui?
Not maybe like interested, but I am curious about Peahi at Jaws. I think it would be really cool to get a wave out there one day. But definitely would take some convincing to do, but it's definitely been a thought.
That was professional surfer Betty Lou Sakura Johnson. The 20-year-old recently finished fifth in the World Surf League's Women's Championship Tour. Now it's time to tell you the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we marked the passing of renowned conservationist Jane Goodall, and we told you about a primate sanctuary in our own backyard. The Pacific Primate Sanctuary had at one point housed dozens of New World monkeys. The primates came from research labs, tourist attractions, or in some cases were household pets. We asked you to tell us where the Pacific Primate Sanctuary is located. Its founders say it is the only location in the States that matched the climate of the monkeys' native jungles in Central and South America. And the answer we were looking for, Haiku, Maui. And congrats to Uta from Manoa, who is a primate fan. Uta got it right. That's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hey, here's a new term, outdoor industrial storage.
There's a limited supply of these spaces. People aren't, you know, clamoring to build more. Cities really don't want big truck parking lots all over the place. So the supply is very limited.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, supply chain sausage making. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
This week on This American Life. When Zoran Mamdani won the primary race for New York mayor a couple months ago, the Democratic establishment didn't exactly embrace him. And it made me think of another charismatic, unconventional candidate years ago who the same thing happened to.
I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago.
Chicago's first black mayor, Harold Washington. How that played out for him this week.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Benjamin Fairfield has made it his mission to give a voice to empty cans, boba straws, and discarded shingles. He turns garbage into musical instruments. Fairfield is a lecturer at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and the author of a new book, Kanikaʻopala, How Can Garbage Sing? He was also recently named one of the state of Hawaii's climate artists in residence. A new exhibit showcasing his work will open this weekend at Capitol Modern. Fairfield spoke with the Conversation's Matty Bender about his unconventional path in creating instruments out of what others might consider trash.
My wife and I were Peace Corps volunteers in Thailand.
The music that I studied during the ethnomusicology program was related to our experience in northern Thailand. And it was a Karen village, so the Karen are an indigenous population along the border of Burma and Thailand, stateless people, no country of their own. But they have this instrument, this harp called a denaku. If you look at it, the strings are untwisted bike brake cables. The membrane is a gas or galvanized metal container. And it's kind of emblematic of these technologies that were thrust upon this indigenous population in northern Thailand. All the development projects have broken down, but they sort of strip it for parts and use what they can and incorporate it into their musical tradition. And so this harp is kind of representative of that. And so as part of my postdoc work at UH, I wanted to create an ensemble that sort of celebrated that with a lens on sustainability and eco-musicology that connects people to place and gets them thinking about materials and sustainability and how we interact with nature through music. And so it's a Thai ensemble at UH, Music 311, and we make all our own instruments from rubbish that our students collect and gather throughout the week, and every week we make a new instrument that has a focus on music of Thailand. From that sort of, I had this growing collection of musical instruments that were just kind of filling the closets and had no space for, and wanted to do something additional with them. And so I thought, well, I should record an album, you know, using just my junk instruments. And so I did that. And I thought, well, I should write a book that, you know, showcases these. And then that book became an illustrated children's book. And then a long process with UH Press became what it is today, which is Kanika Opala, How Can Garbage Sing? So that's the book. And the title, of course, is a play on Kanika Pila. Kanika Pila means to jam on instruments, pila being instruments, and opala being rubbish.
What are some of the principles to making an instrument out of trash items? Like, what have you learned over the years of doing this and, you know, embedding in those communities in Thailand,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, no, it's definitely been a process for me and the students as things work or don't work. And it's more like analyzing the materials that are already at play, like a string. Okay, you need a string, so something that can be stretched and tightened. And so traditionally, this might have been silk or rattan or some sort of natural material. And then we move on to fishing line and bike brake cables and things that sort of have the same properties. And so exploring those kind of materials and characteristics with all the elements of the musical instruments and tin cans. Like, I wanted to, because a lot of Thai music traditions have gongs and we can't melt down metal in our class. But tin cans can be pounded in a way that you can tune them, kind of how you do like steel drum tuning. Create whole gongs out of tin cans and, you know, just exploring the possibilities of these things that people write off as worthless and things that have no utility, and we find that they still do have a voice.
What you said earlier about using items from a place and really being in tune with traditions and the history of a place as you're finding trash to make into instruments really struck me. And it reminded me of something I saw on your YouTube channel, which was a tutorial on how to make a spam can into an instrument. So talk a little bit about that, and also just like what kinds of cool synergies, I guess, arise when you can make a very localized product or transformation.
Well, first, I should give a shout out to Dr. Aaron Salah, who got me thinking about this when he asked the question, you know, why is it that we're teaching music in Hawaii with the windows closed, as, you know, metaphorically, like disconnected from the campus around us, the place that we're in? And so I was teaching a world music class, and we were building canjos, which is kind of a version of the diddly bow from the American South, where they would nail a wire to the pillar of, you know, the commissary, the porch. And then they would stick a tin can underneath that wire, then sort of pluck it. You're just like playing on the porch. And so we made a portable version of that in my first time I taught world music. And I thought, well, what if we made it more like a luau, like a beach luau version of this? So you've got a piece of wood, and instead of a metal wire, which we don't have, we have fishing line, which you can find on the beach. And you have chopsticks, which, you know, are part of the potluck. And you also have a red solo cup instead of a can. And so, like, getting students to think about, like, it's music, it's performativity, but it's also connected to the social atmosphere and the community of the music that you're making, and gets you to think about the materials that are otherwise destined for the landfill and for age power, like giving them a second life and a second voice.
Yeah, on that topic of sustainability, I feel like it's good to bring up the fact that you're a climate change fellow, and there is an art exhibit that will be on view through the end of the month. I feel like there's this tension sometimes when we talk about reusing items and creative ways of incorporating sustainability, that what we're talking about is at a scale that is nowhere near what we would actually need to create like a quote unquote circular economy. Mm-hmm. But how do you feel like your work fits in, if not at the scale that's going to make a dent, maybe having people think about what to do the next time they have household trash?
Yeah. So I'm not of the opinion that I'm really making much of a dent in the constant flow of rubbish that we are all creating in our everyday lives. These things they're temporarily diverted from the landfill, and they're eventually going to end up somewhere anyway. But part of this climate residency is just getting artists involved in the conversation and helping to sort of get people to think about these things. Because it's such a mindless activity, right? You have a tin can that's pulled out of the soils of West Africa, that's shipped across the Atlantic, that's turned into a can filled with beans, shipped across the U.S. to Matson ports in Seattle or San Pedro in L.A., then shipped across the Pacific and onto the container to the Don Quixote, then to our shelves, and then you buy it for $2, and then you don't even acknowledge the can. You just throw it away and take the stuff out of the can. But it doesn't go away. Obviously, it goes out to H-Power. It's burned. It becomes air. When you burn it into smoke or ash, it becomes leached into the soil. The economy that we have found ourselves in is such that we devalue it and label it worthless and then give ourselves license to throw it away. And this project is basically just asking, is it really worthless? Doesn't it have a voice? Can't it be part of our song? Can't we stop and acknowledge the work that can is doing? It's done amazing things. It's brought food to us that's edible and somehow economical. And just taking a moment to pause and acknowledge that can. And that sort of mindset gets us thinking about circularity and also acknowledging other things that sustain us in our lives, the Aina, our community, people that are just a part of our experience and existence and sustenance.
Let's talk just a little bit about this book. I wish listeners could see what's going on. You not only wrote it, but also illustrated it.
Right.
And it looks to me kind of like some type of mixed media of like watercolor, I imagine, or these like plastic shards maybe,
mm-hmm.
and cardboard. How did you tackle the challenge or think about the opportunity to illustrate and write this book?
So I guess the book started during COVID. My son and I, he had no school, and we were just at Ala Moana Beach every day for 90 days straight. We'd go there in the morning to give my wife time to do her work, and then we'd kind of switch off halfway through the day with childcare. And every time we went, I wouldn't bring any toys or anything, and we'd always find stuff that either washed up or was unearthed from the sand, that just things just kept appearing everywhere, all these different plastic toys. And I was thinking, what if I turned all these into, you know, musical instruments at like a whole flotsam exhibit or something, you know? And that sort of became the setting for the book, which is set at Magic Island. And it's a father and daughter character. And they basically go around the loop on Magic Island. And the dad has a yellow bucket. And they go around collecting things the whole time and playing this game called the question game, where they're just sort of interrogating these labels. Like, is it really worthless? Can you throw it away? Where is away? Like, sort of just challenging those really quick labels and narratives. And as you notice, the visuals, it's watercolor, but there's also little elements of trash throughout. Like there's popsicle sticks, there's boba straws, there's plastic bags, there's bottle caps. And all those things that you see in the initial story become part of the musical instruments they create at the end. And so the second half of the book is tutorials that you can do at home with your kids or nephews and nieces or just by yourself, because they're really fun ways to sort of engage with the rubbish you might have at home that you would otherwise throw away. You can stop and try out one of these activities.
You brought a few of your instruments here today, so I'd love if you could describe a few of them to listeners and maybe play us a little bit from them.
Oh, yes, please. Okay. So mostly my primary instruments are stringed instruments, but I explore all categories. So this is a PVC pipe, and it's got some holes in it. But here is a PVC pipe flute. And so this is a piece of banyan from a tree that fell down on University Avenue in 2023 at Church of the Crossroads. So the banyan tree was 80 years old, and it fell down, and it was like this big sort of iconic banyan tree over by Varsity that was just full of minor birds. Like when you walked by, it was just this overwhelming sound of minor birds. As they were hauling it away, I asked if I could just grab a plank of it to turn into a banyan. They said, yeah, sure, like, because otherwise it was just going to be burned or mulched. And so it's got 8 strings that are made out of fishing line. The plate right here in the middle is from a shingle that also blew off the same church. I wanted to write a song that sort of celebrated the life of the banyan tree, but also deal with loss. And so when things fall and we imagine that's the end of them and they're leaving our lives and they're not going to be a part of us anymore. And if I can dedicate this to my friend from college, Mish, who passed away from cancer very recently. also loss as part of this process.
Once upon a century, great Grammy plants a banyan tree. Its branches then were tall as you and me. Birds above and roots below, we gave it love and watched it grow. And there it stood till 2023. Oh, the canopy of shade, the grass is where we played, the miners on parade. Oh, their song would fill the air, in awe we'd stop and stare and find sanctuary in the rain. The winds came rushing down the ridge, rattled fences, bent the bridge, shook the shingles, ripped them from the roof. Bending, breaking, crashing down, branches fell and cracked the ground, the minor birds evicted from their roosts. Oh, the splinters in our eyes, unready for goodbyes, now open are the skies. Oh, the empty corner calls, the gentle giant falls, the silence and the sighs. Yesterday a tree, now it's just a breeze, they're hauling her away. Oh, it's natural to clean feels inadequate to sing. Nothing we could do would make her stay. Blinking tears mourn we must, shrinking fears stardust to dust. The substance shifts, but nothing ever leaves. Watching her, we learn to grow. Her body's gone, but still we know her mana and our future is a seed. Oh, the forest or the trees, the chorus of the leaves, they breathe within our speech. The minas haven't lost their voice, our view is still a choice. We can reconnect if we just reach.
That was artist and musician Benjamin Fairfield talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Fairfield's new book is out with UH Press. It's entitled Kani Ka'opala, How Garbage Can Sing. And that official exhibit opening for Hawaii's Four Climate Artists in Residence will be held on Saturday, October 4th at Capitol Modern. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show for you. Next week, Wait, Don't Tell Me comes to Honolulu. We catch up with host Peter Sagal and replay some conversations that we've had over the years with some of the show regulars. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.